Good afternoon. This is the Professor Dr. Ron Daniels, President of the Institute of the Black World 21st Century and Distinguished Lecturer Emeritus from York College, City University of New York, welcoming you to the September 12th edition of Vantage Point here on 99.5 FM, that's WBAI, on the Pacifica Network in collaboration with ycradio.org. That's right, the York College radio community is plugged in to WBAI, expanding the breadth and width and informational base for WBAI by way of Vantage Point. Well, this afternoon, I'm delighted to have Jesse Jackson Jr., former congressman, also a author, commentator, to be my very, very special guest. As many of you may know, I served as deputy campaign manager. If you don't, I served as deputy campaign manager for Reverend Jesse Jackson's 1988 presidential campaign. I served as the executive director of the National Rainbow Coalition. And one of the great experiences of my life was having played an integral role in a presidential campaign. And in that capacity, you know, had the opportunity to build a relationship with the family in general, but I think a special relationship with Jesse Jackson Jr. So I'm delighted he'll be joining us today to talk about what he's been up to and where he sees himself moving and where he sees the world moving in relationship to issues that are facing us. In addition to that, we hope to open up the phones at the bottom of the, or at least at the end of the program, as the professor goes up on the soapbox to take your input. Now, what I particularly want to do today is get your reactions to the passing of Queen Elizabeth II and the crowning of King Charles III. A lot of discussion about it. The whole world is watching and riveted at every part of the pomp and ceremony and circumstance. It is just all-consuming, if you will. But I'm interested in getting your reaction. And then I would like to call your attention in particular to an article by a sister journalist whose name is Karen Atia. She is a Ghanaian journalist married to a her parents, one is Ghanaian, one is Nigerian. And she is the global opinion editor for the Washington Post, of all places. And she laid down a very interesting piece, which is entitled, We Must Face the Ugly Truths About Elizabeth, Queen Elizabeth, and Great Britain. It is strong, very interesting. And right in the middle of all this celebration, she drops this piece from a major mainstream media outlet. Saw her on CNN yesterday, and she didn't change or back down. She was still articulating a very strong perspective. You can actually view the article. I'm sure that Don Rojas has posted it on the IBW website at ibw21.org. That's ibw21.org. And again, it is the sister's name is Karen Atia. She is a African. She is a continental African who is in the United States, U.S. citizen actually. And but again, the global opinion editor for the Washington Post. Young person, about 36 years old, as I was reading her bio, but she dropped this piece. We must face the ugly truths about Queen Elizabeth and Great Britain. And I must say, this is percolating into the conversation. You're hearing it percolate, particularly around the Commonwealth and its role historically and whatnot. So again, it's just interesting at the height of this conversation that that would be raised. Now, in advance, I'm going to give you the number that you can file away when we open the phones at the end of our broadcast, or for the last about 15 minutes or so. 212-209-2877. 212-209-2877. will be the number to call, and we hope that we'll get rapid-fire responses, as many as possible. I always enjoy the interaction with the audience. But today, we'd be just interested in hearing your comments and how appropriate you feel these reactions may or may not be within the context of the passing of the Queen and the crowning of the new King of Great Britain, Charles the Third. Again, we are waiting to get Jesse Jackson Jr. on the line. He hasn't responded yet. I hope that he will do so soon, as he certainly agreed to do the interview. Again, Jesse Jackson Jr. is among the siblings, obvious, of Reverend Jesse Lewis Jackson. Jonathan Jackson is probably, I think, the eldest son, is running for Congress of the United States, actually replacing Bobby Rush. Bobby Rush, of course, a former Black Panther. Of course, there is Santita, and then there is a little Jackie, as we called her, and then Yusef. So there's a very, very robust family tree that Jacqueline Jackson and Reverend Jesse Jackson has spawned. And they're all doing various things, along the way. We're, again, now waiting to try to make the connection. I hope we have the right number. I'm going to double check it as I actually talked to Jesse Jackson Jr. The other day, and he certainly agreed to do this. And we indicated to him that we would be calling him. I hope he has the time right, though. I think he's in Washington. Well, he may be in Chicago, Ashley, but certainly hope that he is plugged in. Just want to check my production sheet to see if I gave the right number on my production sheet. And I double checked it, and it is the right number. So we'll just wait a minute or two, or we'll take a break, and then I may make a call to see whether we can connect with him, because we were really excited about this interview and really expecting him to call in. Yeah, the number is, as our producer has it, that is the correct number, and we'll just wait a few minutes to see whether or not he picks up. If not, we'll take a quick break, and I'll do some securities investigation and try to plug him in. We certainly hope we can get him in, because Jesse Jackson Jr. is someone who we were sharing information the other day. I was a part of my duties as a deputy campaign manager for Reverend Jesse Jackson was to actually go to the South, to Atlanta, to run the regional office for the Rainbow, for the Jackson campaign. I actually had served as executive director. I was pulled over to go to the campaign, which I actually was somewhat reluctant to do, but was asked to do by Reverend Jesse Jackson. And in that regard, it was quite an experience. But it was interesting that Reverend Jackson and Mrs. Jackson sent Jesse Jackson Jr. with us to help open up the Southern office for the Jackson campaign. And that was for the whole Southern region. I think it was I was responsible for 12 of the 13 Super Tuesday states. 12 of the 13 Super Tuesday states. I think Texas had a separate plan for the state of Texas. And it was interesting because it was Jesse Jackson Jr.'s first experience, really, doing that kind of political organizing, along with a brother named Lou Carter, who had been with the Urban League, very, 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 very skilled organizer, Jackson devotee, along with Joe Beasley out of Atlanta. And we set the task of organizing the Southern region for a tremendous victory that led to, I think we actually won first place in 6 or 7 of the Super Tuesday states. Reverend Jackson carried Super Tuesday back in the day. That's the 88 campaign. And Reverend Jesse Jr. went out on his very, very first endeavor. We sent him out on his very first effort as a result of being there in Atlanta. And, you know, we, again, like I said before, forged a strong relationship. He subsequently went on to run for Congress and win a congressional seat where he did extremely well. In fact, he was even mentioned at one point to be a vice presidential candidate. Along the way, however, he did fall on hard times in relationship to allegations of congressional misconduct, and it was really quite a steep fall, both in terms of his political career, but also in terms of just his personal life. There's actually some mental challenges that were revealed that were part of it. But he went off and did his time and has come back and is likely to be working to make a comeback, if you will. And we wanted to talk. That's why we listed the segment, Catching Up with Jesse Jackson Jr. And we're still trying to catch up with him. So I don't know whether or not we can take a musical interlude, a pause, where I can actually make some independent inquiries to see what is, you know, what is happening in relationship to that. So that's what we'll do, and we'll come right back, hopefully having caught up with Jesse Jackson Jr.
All right, this is WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org online. The name of the program is Vantage Point with the Professor Ron Daniels. Yes, I am not Ron Daniels. I am the other person that you hear on the air on occasion throughout the day. Reggie, that's me. We're still getting in, trying to get in touch with Jesse Jackson Jr. And we will let you know what the results will be. But in the meantime, take a listen to some more music. Previously, you heard John Coltrane's Alabama, and now you're hearing Herbie Hancock's Vein Melter. So stay tuned.
And I think we've made our connection. I think we had a misconnection on Central Time versus Eastern Standard Time. Seems to have been the problem. So I'll get a notice in a minute. I just actually spoke to Jesse Jr. myself a minute ago, and so hopefully we're going to get this connection made. And we'll move along. We probably won't have any audience call in because we certainly want to hear from him in terms of what he's been up to and various other aspects of his life and as a part of an incredibly important civil rights family, which is not the easiest thing to do and to be, frankly, and particularly if you have a name like Jesse Jackson Jr. Sometimes that's not the easiest thing to do. So we're trying to make the connection now, and when I get the notice, we'll dive right into it. All right. Okay, so we're ready to go. So, again, our apologies to our audience. We had a little miscue in terms of the difference between Central Standard Time and Eastern Standard Time. We're on Eastern Standard Time. Jesse Jackson Jr. is on Central Time, so that's the miscue, but that's okay. We're ready to go. Jesse Jackson Jr., welcome to Vantage Point.
It's my honor. Professor, please accept my apologies. I mean, if I were coming to your class today, I would be getting somewhere around a C-minus being late.
No, it's okay. We just, I should have emphasized it a little bit more in terms of what we're doing, but that's okay. We'll push right ahead. Again, we're delighted to have you on, and had talked about really in an introductory way the kind of special relationship that I feel for and have with the Jackson family, having been honored to be Deputy Campaign Executive Director of the Rainbow Coalition and Deputy Campaign Manager, but beyond that, really having been with the family and being around the family and building relationships with the family. And I shared how you came to Atlanta, Georgia, and we launched really the Southern campaign that led to the victory on Super Tuesday. So, again, very, very, very special relationship.
Your leadership during that period and ongoing period has been instrumental in shaping progressive politics in this country. And you are not an unsung hero. You are a hero of that process that laid the foundation for the current politics that led to a progressive African-American president of the United States. Thank you, Dr. Daniels, for having me.
Well, we appreciate that. Before we sort of get into the sort of a substance of the conversation, just want to ask how we're always interested in knowing how Reverend Jackson is. How's he faring?
The Reverend's in a season. He has been in Shirley Ryan Rehab Center for the last month. We expect him to get out this Thursday, and so we are extremely grateful as a family for all of your prayers. Parkinson's, as you know, is a very serious, debilitating illness. And Reverend had a UTI, a urinary tract infection, about a month ago. And when we put him in the hospital just for 3 days to address the UTI, as you know, 3 days without moving, laying in the bed, means you have to learn how to use everything all over again.
Right.
How to walk, how to use your arms. And so please keep him in your prayers, and he sends you his very best, Dr. Daniels.
All right. Appreciate that. Well, you've been off the public stage for quite a while, and after a remarkable tenure as Congressman Jesse Jackson, Jr., an author, commentator. So talk to us, to our audience, about where you are currently in your life's mission and journey.
Well, let me thank you very much for that opportunity. As you know, I served 17 years in the Congress of the United States. I was very proud of that career, which I thought was exemplary. And then I fell from grace, and I may have fallen actually into grace. I spent 30 months in a federal prison. While there, I met some fairly extraordinary individuals, did 3 days in solitary confinement for helping men read who could not read or write, fill out pardon applications. And there I made a constitutional discovery, which laid the foundation for my new work, which is called The Finger of God, which is available on Amazon. I made a discovery in the Constitution of the United States in the September 17, 1787 document that essentially shows that America was a theological experiment at its inception. And so building out this discovery, I have been working with a number of scholars, Cornel West, Dr. James Forbes, Susanna Heschel, Dr. Nasir Ghami, trying to explore what this infinity language represents in the Constitution and the ways in which we might use it to help oppress people, not only in our own country, but around the world.
Wow. Wow, that was good. And talk to us about the experience of working with other incarcerated men and what their experiences are like and their lives and just what life is like, because many of these folks are diamonds in the rough, really.
You know, Dr. Daniels, it's the stories. And I never, on my way into prison, I was in a depressed state because I had fallen from grace. I had fallen from a pretty lofty perch in American society. I was who I was. I am who I am. And I was, you know, kind of debilitated for the first month or two. But as I began listening to men tell me their stories, their upbringings, and the circumstances of their life, I began to feel less sorry for myself, and I began to understand that all of us were going through something, and right. Tried to make the best use of my time by listening to their stories, trying to get the attention of the President of the United States, then Barack Obama, to consider their clemency, to consider their forgiveness, to reunite families. And on that road, I discovered a power placed in the Constitution, so powerful, but yet so unused that it's just a cause of reflection. But these men and their stories, you know, as soon as you start feeling bad about yourself and someone else walks up to you and tells you something even worse than happened to them and you see that they are resilient and that they bounce back and that they keep it moving, it takes a burden off of you to move from self-pity to help.
I'm eager to get your, because you're also a political commentator, you have a political perspective, you have been around progressive politics all of your life and civil rights and human rights work, and willingly so and eagerly so, in a very, very positive way. So I'm wondering, I'd like to just get your perspective on a range of current issues, including how do you assess the current, dare I say, MAGA, Make America Great Again, dominated Republican Party in terms of the threat to democracy?
So the reason Jesse Jackson sent you and Lou Carter and me to the South in Atlanta and kick off the campaign down there were because these states were organizing. At the time, with Ralph Reed and Billy Graham and Jerry Falwell, if you remember, were starting something called the Christian Coalition.
Yes.
And we knew that behind the theology of that was states' rights, conservative, neo-Confederate ideology. So we went down there county to county under your leadership, and we began registering people to vote, really laying the foundation for some of the work that Stacey Abrams is doing in Georgia. But it's the work that you and I did, along with the late Lou Carter, in Texas, Alabama, Louisiana, Mississippi, Tennessee, Georgia, North and South Carolina. And obviously, Reverend Jackson showed that in a multi-candidate field, and then ultimately after the convention with Jesse's rules, where we arrive at proportionality in terms of you actually being able to get your share of delegates, we laid the foundation for the Obama presidency in 2008, which I had the privilege of being the co-chairman of. So what we are seeing here is a resurgence of the states, states' rights activism. You see that the historian John Meacham is trying to give some foundation to Joe Biden by talking about this in the context of what occurred during the Civil War and after the Civil War. And so we have this MAGA movement on the one hand. You have Joe Biden on the other hand trying to build a more perfect union. And at the same time, we must have an unprecedented amount of registered voters come this midterm election and in 2024 if we want to put this sleeping giant back to bed.
And I want to go back because there are people who tend to think that the emergence of, I call him, you know, this is my, I call him Agent Orange or the Orange Man, which is astounding that this could happen, except people tend to forget the origins of this strand, going all the way back to Reagan and Nixon, the Southern campaign, the so-called Southern strategy. You know, having seen what happened with the campaigns of George Wallace, appealing to racial animus and racial grievance and the kind of way in which it was attracting people.
And Willie Horton, all of that stuff right there is now right in front of us again. And you are so right. It's always been coded language, but I think in the post-George Floyd world, and Generation Z, they just want authenticity. They just want the truth. They don't want to hear all of these, and they know exactly what the code words are, by the way. They're far quicker than our parents were, or even we were, in understanding that there's something not right in the spirit of that language that they're trying to use to hurt people. And they're just not putting up with it. So, you know, this is going to be quite a battle, but we have to engage it, Dr. Daniel.
Right. So, Nemi, you mentioned President Biden, and there's been, and you mentioned Meacham, and I think there were some historians who got together recently to try to apprise the president of the real dangers of the moment. In fact, I would suspect, to me, there's almost a way in which this stuff has become normalized. I mean, there was the insurrection, there was an attack on the Capitol, unprecedented stuff, and frankly, one of the things that I have pointed to time and time again, that any one of just legions of grievances and misconduct, and that if Obama had done any of these things, he would have been impeached and in jail by now. I mean, it's just so glaring. But setting that aside, the question becomes really, what is your assessment of Biden's response, both in terms of, first of all, a policy agenda, but also in terms of just his grasp of the moment and therefore leading in that regard?
And that's one heck of a question that you're asking, Dr. Daniels, because it requires some context. Now, a lot of people don't want to give Lincoln credit with freeing the slaves, but the fact of the matter is no blacks could vote, no women could vote in 1860. That's true. They couldn't vote in 1864 for Abraham Lincoln. That's true. In 1860, his name did not appear on a Southern ballot. That's true. His name did not appear on a Southern ballot in 1864. That's true. So Abraham Lincoln, for his almost 5 years as president before assassination, is talking to only white men who can vote. And he's got an army chasing down white Southern men who left the Union. So the first thing you have to do is come up with a language which may not be anti-slavery, but you must come up with a language amongst all white men who are doing all of the voting to win the presidency. And then when you win the presidency, provoke the South at Fort Sumter. Make them secede from the Union. And then convince the North they don't have a right to leave the Union. So you can build a coalition of Northern white folks who are prepared to go South and say you don't have a right to leave. Then you double back and you say, now, the moral cause of this war isn't that they just left, but that they're protecting this ungodly institution called slavery. So I'm going to issue an Emancipation Proclamation. Now, I'm going to free the slaves not where I control them in the middle states or in the border states. I'm going to free them where I don't control them to add some moral impetus to getting off those plantations and helping us with the war effort. And then after they're freed, I've got to lock in something specific to keep the country, after I'm no longer president, from slipping back into slavery. I need the Congress of the United States to pass the 13th Amendment, and I need them to do it in my administration so the country doesn't slip back into slavery should I get unelected or should I leave. That would ultimately lead to the Reconstruction Amendments, the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments. What we're missing from Biden is, one, a serious series of cases before the federal courts that expand the 14th Amendment and Reconstruction. We're doing a lot of talking. We're doing a lot of voting. But we're not fighting for any fact pattern before the federal judiciary that is unassailable that expands the 14th Amendment. We're on the retreat in that regard. And you know as well as I know that when I was in Congress, I advanced in 2001 until the day I left Congress in 2012, 9 amendments to the Constitution that would protect our basic human rights. And we called that book, Frank Watkins and I, A More Perfect Union, so that each of these amendments could overcome states' rights and keep us from slipping back into the condition that we find ourselves in right now. And so, whether it's Trump who wanted to begin his campaign at Gettysburg because he wants to reinterpret July 4th, or whether it is this MAGA crowd running through the Capitol on January 6th, these are very, very perilous times that are being led by historians. And I want to make, and Newt Gingrich, by the way, very much on Trump's team, is a historian. The problem we have is our so-called decent liberal historians, from my perspective, like Doris Kearns Goodwin and John Meacham, they're filling Biden with the rhetoric of Lincoln, but not the work of organizing liberal white folks to understand that their destiny is tied to ours. And so you can't spend 50 years just talking about Roe v. Wade, and after many years of serving in Congress, you all haven't even offered a single piece of legislation to codify it. And then when the court comes up here and takes it back from you in the Dobbs case, then you're suddenly mad at everybody because you didn't do your job as a Congress. And that's because of those moderate Democrats in Congress who are always, what, pro-life.
Well, that's a lot to chew on. I was going to reference your work on those nine legislative proposals grounded in your advancing sort of the concept that certainly Martin Luther King worked on, and it was built really on Roosevelt's concept of four freedoms, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, the whole fundamental concept of an economic bill of rights.
The very stuff they don't want taught in schools, which only comes when it's taught with the proper understanding of our history. That's what our history shows.
Right. But you talk about making an unassailable case before the federal judiciary. But is it not the case that federal judiciary has been essentially captured by the Federal Society, they have been systematic and planning to take over the judiciary, hence people's willing to hold their nose and vote for Trump, knowing that they would advance a retrograde, you know, right-wing agenda if they could get enough judges at all levels, not at the district court levels, the circuit court level, as well as the Supreme Court.
So where's our society? I'm aware of the Federalist Society. Where's our society? What group is training progressive judges for presidential appointment to expand equal protection of the law? Where's our society? Where are the endowments at Howard University Law School, where Thurgood Marshall and Constance Baker Motley were trained in the law, and the Pauli Murrays of life, and the Higginbothams of life, who fight these progressive cases? Who's endowing our law schools and bringing forward these progressive legal fighters and jurists in the future? Are we just going to law school, get us a job, go to a firm, get a little money, and then wait for try not to do wrong, wait for a president to discover us and appoint us? Where is our alternative to the Federalist Society? I haven't heard of one yet. Now, I'm almost 60 years old, so we have to kind of, those of us in our age groups, we have to kind of put forward a plan and the resources necessary to produce the kind of fighters for our way of life in the legal system that that we have not been able to do in the past, nor have we ever shown any real interest in that. Now, if I was 21 years old, Dr. Daniels, 18 years old when you met me, almost 40 years ago, I would have a very, very different take on my own enthusiasm and motivation. But now my daughter has graduated from college, and my son is now at Morehouse College. And so I'm very interested in their engagement of this at the level of Thurgood Marshall, Pauli Murray, and Constance Baker Motley. My time's up, almost up. There's some things that I can do, and I am going to do at my age. I'm not asking anyone to sacrifice or be willing to put up their body and sacrifice their life at 21. That's something some old folk like me and you need to do. Put our body up and put some sacrifice in the game so that they can we can create a generation of fighters to do what these people have done on our side.
Well, very, very, again, words of great strength and wisdom. And it does speak to, again, the lack of institutional development, not only in our community, but you know, we always seem to be struggling also with our relationship. It's a very kind of ambivalent relationship with the Democratic Party, actually. In the last election, you know, there was a choice between Trump and Hillary Clinton. And, of course, you know, we get caught in these situations where we have moderates and blue dogs and various other configurations within the Democratic Party, which in some ways I've been trying to say is sort of the reality of the diversity of the Democratic Party. I'm old enough to understand and remember when there was a Republican Party that was far more diverse than it is now. People tend to forget that Lyndon Baines Johnson, when he had somebody to cut a deal with. Not all Democrats were down with any of the Civil Rights Act. There were Dixiecrats who were definitely not on board. But people do not remember that there was a Keating, there was a Case, there was Javits, there was Rockefeller, there was the silver-haired orator from Illinois who was out there, Dirksen, who represented a moderate wing that allowed for Johnson to actually cut a deal, to make a deal, to advance the civil rights bills and so forth. What we now have in the Republican Party is conservatism, and even ultra-right conservatism is synonymous with republicanism, which is a drastic kind of change, and so it seems to me it speaks to, again, the need for clear analysis. And one of the things that I pointed out was, I mean, none of these politicians are perfect, and one of the things that I was concerned about in the Clinton-Trump election was my fear of what I've been calling a Plessy versus Ferguson moment, knowing that the Republicans have wanted to take the judiciary. And the one thing we know is whatever flaws that Hillary Clinton may have had, she would not have appointed all of these right-wing, retrograde, some of them totally inexperienced judges to the bench as a way of advancing this retrograde agenda. So I don't know how you feel about that, but it seems that we're caught in these moments.
You're spot on, but it won't be an anti. It won't be a Plessy versus Ferguson moment. It's going to be an anti-Brown versus the Board of Education moment, which, you know, Brown overturned Plessy. So they're very forthright and very clear. Several senators and congressmen said Brown versus the Board of Education is next. Well, that's everything. That's affirmative action. That's integration of schools. That's the right of HBCUs to exist because these white colleges still don't let our children in. Do you realize that the 110 HBCUs still graduate more black baccalaureate degrees than all of the white schools combined? That's still true. So the black middle class comes from these colleges that are under attack if Brown versus the Board of Education is under attack. It means that black airline pilots, black plumbers, black workers, black construction workers, black contractors, it means that the whole universe of minority set-asides and minority participations gets set aside if they take away Brown versus the Board of Education. And that is our point, your point, and it's my point, that we have to come at this not just marching. That's great. Thurgood Marshall appreciated Dr. King marching, and Dr. King appreciated Thurgood Marshall's legal efforts to bring about Brown versus the Board of Education. But we need a legal strategy that's backed up by our marches. So it's not just enough for Rosa Parks to sit in. We must have a legal strategy to bail people out when y'all get arrested. It's not just enough to march across Edmund Pettus Bridge. We must also have a legal strategy that allows us to register and vote and beat back Bull Connor, beat back George Wallace, and run them out of office. We must have a legal strategy, because beyond the moral cause of motivating people with protests, we must have a legal strategy by locking our progress in place with the law.
Now, that brings me to where we are now, because one of the things that I so appreciated by Reverend Jesse Lewis Jackson, and to some degree also Walter Fauntleroy. Walter Fauntleroy talked about the arithmetic of our power. He continually tried to talk to black voters. And this is not in any racial sense of exclusion. It was just to understand how, within the context of a society where racism and white supremacy still permeate, and why and where it has been used as a strategy of divide and exploit and conquer, which I must say the Jesse Jackson campaigns of 1984 and 1988 countered in ways not seen since the populist revolts in the 19th century, with economic common ground, beginning to get people to see the commonality of their interests as a way of dealing with the real questions of racialized capitalism and exploitation on the part of the rich and the super rich. The role that black people play in that, in terms of the importance of marching on ballot boxes, the margins of difference between blacks who are registered and vote and those who don't vote. And Reverend Jackson used to point out over and over again that, and he wasn't doing this to indict us, he wasn't doing this to just point out, as he said in one of his speeches in Philadelphia, the rocks just laying around, how if we just pick up these rocks, if we can inspire these rocks, we have the capacity to have power disproportionate to our numbers. This is the way I put it, in my own little simple-minded way. The biggest political party in America is not the Republicans, it's not the Democrats. Quiet as it's kept, this is slightly hyperbole, but not overly so. It's non-voters. Large numbers of people in the United States of America, including large numbers of white people, do not vote. So
I'm going to mix your voting theory. I'm going to mix your voting theory with a generational change theory as well. I'm really impressed with that 25-year-old young man who won down there in Florida. I put his name on the line, and now it looks like he's going to Congress. We got to change the guard, too. I'm impressed with the squad in Congress. I know you are, Dr. Daniels.
That's right.
I know
That's
you
right.
are. But these folks ain't got no more energy, holding all the leadership positions. Ain't registered nobody to vote, doing all the talking slow, looking tired. Ain't nobody following them. That's true. And so we got to give people something to vote for.
That's right.
Now, I don't know how we got from a 39 to 45-year-old president in JFK to now every Democratic candidate running for office has to be 70-plus. I don't understand that. And if for no other reason, they're out of touch. And they're wheeler dealers. I hope a dozen people run for president in 2024 to help Joe Biden get some energy and some steam. I hope it happens. I don't think it gets a pass. I'm very happy with what looks like some improvements in the economy. I'm very happy with some progress made on some, the passage of some key pieces of legislation, particularly the economic legislation that needs to happen. I'm excited about some of the other prospects of what Joe Biden is doing. But Joe's moving a little slow now.
I agree.
Joe's struggling now. And ain't no need enough sitting here acting like he ain't struggling. On the other side, look at Ron DeSantis. I mean, look at these cats who are coming with vitriol and how nasty they are. Jim Jordan. Look how young these cats are. And these cats plan to be around for 40 years raising this kind of hell. Now, we need an alternative group of people raising our kind of hell. John Lewis called it good trouble.
That's right.
And we just, you know, ain't nobody got no energy over here. Everybody holding on to their retirement checks. Man, listen, it's time for a change.
Yeah.
It's time for a change, and we need this generation to start talking about that change. And it's going to hurt a little bit, too, by the way, because I really feel like I'm still in the youth. And I'm almost 60, man.
But you're right, because at one level, it's really not about chronological age, it's about your vision and your sense of where to go and how to move, frankly. And I totally agree that unfortunately we have some, you know, elected officials who just thought that the effort was to change, you know, black faces for white places, for white faces in old places, and that would be sufficient. Just happy to be there. And frankly, are not registering people. They are not going out for fear that they will not vote for them. Which is crazy. We need to be mobilizing black voters, but we have to give them something, like you said before, to vote for. And we need people like, you know, I'm so proud of people, you know, like Sister Brown, who has Black Voters Matter, and a number of other people who are doing that work. Unfortunately, we're going to have to do it on our own because we the messaging coming out of the Biden administration, there is this fear of speaking to black voters for fear that it will alienate white voters. Where really in the trade-off, there are far more younger black voters who would come and vote and would be the margin of victory if they were not so hesitant to actually address our concerns, not in a racial negative exclusionary way, but in just in terms of the positivity of what's needed. And what's good for us is good for America. It will benefit everybody, I think.
No, and you got to win. And you got to win. And that's what a lot of people and their analysis fail to understand, which I know you do understand. You have to win. So if Abraham Lincoln ran in 1860, promising to free all slaves, promising reparation, civil rights, and the right to vote for black people once they freed, he never would have won. He'd just been a preacher. In 1860, if that was his platform, he wouldn't have won because he's only speaking to white male voters. What's in it for them other than discord? So he was smart enough to craft a message that allowed him to win. And he crafted it in a way that Southern forces seceded. Then he argued, you don't have a right to secede. So I'm going to go up here to the Northeast. I'm going to get the Massachusetts 54th. I'm going to get McClellan, and I'm going to come down there and bring your state back in this union. It's going to be an ugly process. So there is a process here to win. I believe that our people are entitled to reparations. But what form should it take, Dr. Daniels? I argue it should come in the form of the 9 amendments I put in a more perfect union. You might say, well, I think it's 40 acres and a mule. And then I'm going to turn around and tell you, here's the problem. I can't get through Iowa on 40 acres and a mule. Or New Hampshire, or South Carolina, I might as well just stay on the south side of Chicago because I can't win the nomination. But I can win the nomination on high-quality education for all and health care for all and a clean, safe, and sustainable environment and putting out forest fires for all. I can win the nomination on ain't nobody gonna fly no more planes in the buildings. That ain't gonna happen. Not on my watch. I can win the nomination on that. And then when I get there, convince the nation that raising people who are the least of these in our society up to their full citizenship rights benefits all of us.
Right.
But I gotta get
right.
there first. We're about out of time.
Just as we're questioning, we'll have to bring you back, and we'll have to discuss reparations because reparations is my wheelhouse these days. Because I am
Man,
at the center of
it.
Leading
you know
the HR 40 coalition. We're doing it globally, and we think that it is possible to do things a certain way. And quite frankly, my position is, having been taught by your father, I still believe in the Rainbow Coalition. I still believe
Lord,
that the Rainbow Coalition is the path. But quite frankly, I think it is now, in our time, more centered and can be led by Black and people of color, and that there is only a certain margin of white folks who are going to join it. There are progressives, there's some workers who will come along, but there's a vast majority of Black folk and people of color, Latinos, Asians, Native Americans, Asian and South Pacificans, Middle Eastern, who can join it and can still carry forth. We got a bail.
Let me know how I can help. Let me know how I can help. I'll come back.
We're literally out of time. Jesse Jackson Jr., we appreciate you so much. Your journey has taken on new life, and we want to bring you back to discuss further that discovery in the Constitution and how that's working. Thank you so much for spending time with us this afternoon on Vantage Point.
Thank you, Dr. Daniels.
All right, folks. Well, we finally did get Jesse Jackson Jr., and we know what Jesse Jackson Jr. is up to. Next week, there'll be a different host on the program as I'm going to be away for a week. But when I come back, we'll be on Vantage Point once again here on 99.5 FM on the Pacifica Dial in collaboration with YCRadio.org.